Guys, welcome back to the Perpetua podcast, the first one of 2021. We're on episode 10 and also our first Zoom call. And I'm delighted to be joined today by
Brian O'Hengisa.
Brian O'Hengisa. I actually listened to a podcast you were on quite recently. I listened to it recently. You were on it ages ago. I'm on Adams on the Mastery podcast.
I re-listened
to him say your name two or three times just because I was like, I don't know how to say this. But yeah, Brian, delighted to have you on here. Would you tell the listeners, the viewers, who you are, what you do, why do I want you on my podcast?
Absolutely. I'll probably ask you why you want me on my podcast. yeah, sure thing. So my name is Brian O'Hengisa. I'm a nutritionist and a nutrition coach, and I have been in that role for, you know, a good few years at this point. And I'm currently working with a triage method. So I'm the head nutritionist there and head nutrition coach. So yeah, I've been working with people on a one-to-one basis for a good few years now. Very much a wide variety of clients working with their nutrition, but in recent times, it's become kind of a niche in helping people with like disordered eating patterns, you know, get away from like binge eating, food anxieties, fear around different foods and that sort of stuff. So very much a mix of clients, and I enjoy that, but that's kind of what I've been pulled towards, I would say, more recently. And, you know, aside from nutrition, I studied nutrition in UCD, got my bachelor's there. I've done the precision nutrition coaching courses, and like, you know, I've interests in like philosophy, as you know yourself, similar to you. And you know, I enjoy training, physical training of all sorts. We're saying there, I'm looking forward to getting back to the Echo bike that's in my sitting room. I'm not at home at the moment, but and when I can do jiu-jitsu, I do jiu-jitsu, but it's been a long time, sadly, since we've been able to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's who I am. And
we've got a fire alarm. I'm not ignoring it. It just keeps going off. Really, really sorry if it ruins the podcast here. Hopefully, Owen will sort that out for us. So you're a nutritionist. First guest we've had on that is purely nutritionist. You don't do any in-person like coaching or training the same way that I would do at all?
No, I've never been one to train people or prescribe exercise programs. Obviously I discuss it with my clients, and it's something that I'm very much personally interested in and always have been. And I'm very into training and fitness and that side of things, but yeah, never in a professional capacity have I coached someone in exercise.
Cool. So like you've mentioned there, you help people with fear of food and binge eating, and would you say that then disordered eating would be your speciality, or do you have a niche in that skill set, or what's your...
Yeah, like it's kind of become, I suppose, a primary skill set for me, because there's a lot of overlap and that sort of thing with like, you know, psychology of human behavior, which is something I'm very interested in anyway. And you know, most of nutrition coaching is about behavior change, and there's huge psychological aspects to it, as opposed to me just saying, okay, James, you eat this, and then come back to me in a week and we'll see how you are. Like that will be fine. And there's a small subset of people that works for, but it's not the majority of people. And it's not the people that I'm working with necessarily. So yeah, it's just something I've come across more and more and have had good results with it and a lot of success. And because of that overlap with my areas of interest, it's just become, and it's very, very fulfilling to help people.
I'd say it is, man. Yeah,
break free from that sort of shit. So while they're not the only clients that I work with, like I work with athletes, work with, you know, Gen Pop, fat loss. Obviously as a nutritionist, then I can advise on digestive things and specific cases that can be resolved nutritionally. But yeah, that's that sort of area for disordered eating patterns, and helping people with that is just, yeah, it's where I've been drawn towards the last kind of year or two.
Awesome. And so what, whenever you're coming, or whenever these people come to see you and they want to work with you and say they have some sort of eating disorder, is there like a particular set of traits that they all tend to have, or like certain habits that they all tend to have, and then you slowly help erode them away and replace them with new ones? Or is it very varied and it changes person to person?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think as time goes on, and obviously the more people you work with, you'll probably start to see patterns emerging. At the moment, there's like a small number of, say, I would say categories or templates that are sort of typical for how people end up in this position. So you may have somebody who is overly restrictive in their food selection, for whatever reason that might be. So it's usually belief driven, you know, this list of foods are bad, therefore I don't eat them. And it's that sort of restrictive nature that leads them into disordered eating patterns and end up binging, because they just go nuts then if they eventually break their diet. For people, like, did air quotes there for anyone who's not watching this. So like that's one major one. Another category would be people who use food as like as an emotional tool, so to help them cope, you know, especially going through a pandemic, like things are a lot more stressful, you know, emotions are higher. And like the way I would describe that is, you know, if you open up a toolbox of coping mechanisms and how you get through these stressful periods in your life, day to day, you know, if you open up your toolbox, eating is the main one that's there for these people. Yeah. And in that case, it's a case of trying to give them more tools to use, because, you know, eating is not necessarily a bad tool to use, you know, to make yourself feel better, essentially. It's when it starts to have a negative impact on your overall life and your overall well-being. That's another key category. And then generally there will be a large amount of, say, preoccupation with how they look physically, yeah, themselves. So there will be like a disproportionate amount of self-worth tied up in physical appearance, yeah, for a lot of these people. And, you know, that there can be many reasons for that. You know, there's a lot of it is down to like history and past experiences, and, you know, potential traumas drive a lot of this stuff. But in that, it's trying to help people move away from focusing solely on physical appearance and, like, say, yeah, body weight or whatever it is. And, you know, if you imagine like a pie chart, if like physical appearance is taking up a huge chunk of their self-worth pie, or the things that make you up, it's trying to focus on other things. So, like, you know, what other things are important to you besides how you look? You know, one of my colleagues, you know, Gary coined the, or at least this is where I first saw it, and I really like it as a quote, but it's like, your body should be the least interesting thing about you. Yeah. You know, for most people, unless it's literally your livelihood, unless you're like a bodybuilder or something, okay, fair enough. But even still, you want to be a more well-rounded human being than just having a set of abs, right?
Yeah. Or something I kind of spoke about on a podcast recently as well was, you don't want to be the person that just talks about training and just talks about what they're eating in a day. Like, if that's all you ever talk about, no one wants to be around you anymore. You should have other interests, other aspects to your life that always add into that. Just on that then, you kind of mentioned like the tools we use to help people get out of bad habits and whatnot. Like, what have you used over the lockdowns to help you stay in a good place with your nutrition and not going overboard with stuff?
Yeah, so for myself personally, like, I think about this a lot. I think about, like, you know, why do I seem to cope so well? And I probably overthink it in a lot of ways, because, you know, one part of me thinks, okay, well, you're very fortunate in the kind of position that you're in your life, that you're, you know, maybe you don't have people that you're trying to care for. You know, I have a secure job because it's online. So I'm not up against things like, you know, having to be at home with my kids, either like out of a job or trying to work at the same time. So like, you know, I'm in a very fortunate position in a lot of ways, but then I also think that the way I try and push myself to perceive things allows me to cope pretty well. And like, that's where we get into like talking about the philosophy and stoicism and gratitude. So, you know, this is not going to be a good idea for everybody, right? Because you don't want to invalidate how you're feeling. Like if you're feeling pretty shit today because of how things are, like, you're not wrong to feel that way. But you know, you asked me the question, how do I cope? So I'm always essentially thinking like how things could be worse. And I'm always exposing myself to accounts of how things are worse. So like, I read a lot of stuff like about the Holocaust and, you know, like say Man's Search for Meaning, like that's not an account of what it's like in a concentration camp. Like there's other accounts of that. But just to keep that in mind, that's like, you know, shit, man, things could be a lot worse. Like, you know, I like and a good example for this whole pandemic, it's like, okay, well, if this is the kind of big crisis or that's in my sort of lifetime or right now, it's like, okay, well, I could be in a trench in a different era. I could be in a trench in France with people shooting at me with a very low chance of surviving that. And if it's a choice between potentially that or just having to be at home in a nice house and lots and like, you know, Netflix available to you and you can still do physical exercise, that's a pretty good deal to me. So
yeah, that's something I've spoke to a few of my clients about too. It's like, just because your problem is a first world problem doesn't detract from it. However, let's bring it back a step if it is becoming overwhelming, and then recognize where things could be significantly worse. At least I still have a roof over my head, family that loves me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's trying to just recognize the problem, accept it, and then work out strategies around it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I'm super conscious that a lot of people are in bad positions, like much worse positions that you or I will be in. You know, if you're at home and you have an abusive partner or something like that, and you're stuck with that all day, like, that's terrible. And, you know, I have to be conscious of that. And like, everyone's individual situation is going to be different. But just to try and maintain that sort of perspective that, you know, try and be grateful for what you do have, essentially. And like, I'm a huge proponent of people having a gratitude practice, like for myself, for clients, for everybody. Because you take things for granted otherwise. Yeah. And also within this, like, I think, and this is like where like physical training and stuff comes in so useful. Like, you know, obviously there's the mental health benefits to it, but also building that resilience and kind of building that tolerance for discomfort. And that's where
you're talking my language, Brian. Now you're talking my language. Yes. This is something I really push for my clients as well. So yeah, that's huge. With the philosophy side of things, like, how did you get into that and the stoicism and meditations and Marcus Aurelius and all that? Was that something you sought out, or what was it?
I think I've been asked this before and I've struggled to give the exact answer because I can't quite remember, but I'm pretty sure I was listening to the Tim Ferriss podcast and either he mentioned stoicism or maybe he was interviewing Ryan Holiday, who is, you know, the author of The Daily Stoic and The Obstacle Is Away and those other books. So I think that's where I first came across it. But I will say, I have to hold my hand up and say that I probably like self-select into it just by my personality anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm if you're that way inclined and you come across this, you'll be like, oh yeah, this is the best thing ever. Cause you relate to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I found it and, you know, I share the Daily Stoic a lot. And as a result, a lot of people tell me on social media that, you know, oh, I saw you sharing that. There's a huge amount of interest in it, which is deadly. And a lot of people pick up the book then and they're like, this is great. And it has that ripple effect, which is, I love that. Like, I like nothing more than for someone to say, hey, you know, I saw the Daily Stoic on your story and I picked up a copy, and you know, it's helped keep my head straight through difficult times like we're in now. So it's the kind of thing that nearly everybody, because it's very relatable philosophy.
Yeah,
you know, it's been around for, you know, a couple of thousand years, but it's super, super,
it's funny relatable. How that works, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, I reckon you were the first person I seen share it as well. And so whenever I picked it up, it was after you'd shared a few days, and I was like, this seems like, because I'd read Meditations and it'd be like Seneca and a bunch of all different ones, but I never got into Ryan Holiday stuff, and it was probably you that put me onto him. So thank you for that. You mentioned there, like, you're a big proponent of gratitude, and you suggest it towards your clients as well. Like, so what way do you get people to buy into that? Because I've tried that and got a bit of resistance from it. So what are your strategies for that?
Yeah, so what's the resistance point usually for them, would you say?
Where they struggle to recognize what things to be grateful for in a day. They're like, I just had a Monday, like nothing happened today. What could I possibly write to be thankful for? Or they think it's just some hippy dippy, airy fairy stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, for the people who say, you know, it's kind of airy fairy, you can show them some scientific support for gratitude, you know, consistently increasing happiness and maintaining that happiness increase, because there's this thing, I think it's called hedonic adaptation, but you know, say if you go and get a new car tomorrow, right, your happiness increases by say 10% or something, but as soon as you normalize to the fact that that's your new car, the effect kind of wears off, and it's only then if you get another yet better car that you will keep that up. So it becomes kind of a hedonic approach.
Or shoes or phones or new clothes or whatever the thing is.
Yeah, exactly. But the research on gratitude practice shows that you get about a 20% increase in your happiness when you're doing it consistently. And even in the studies, they only did it once a week. And so I'm obviously pushing people to do it, you know, every day if they can, or 5 days a week. But you know, if that helps develop buy-in, and you say to your clients, okay, I just want you to try it twice a week, you know, that's can still have the benefits. And you know, so show the people that think it's airy fairy that there's scientific proof to say, like, this can make you happier, this can make you sleep better, this can improve your tolerance to pain, and all these other things. And then there are some common pitfalls, right? So like you said, it's people are like, well, what the hell do I write about? Or the one that comes up the most, I would say, is like people become stagnant in their topics of gratitude. So it's, you know, I wake up in the morning, I say, I'm grateful for my friends, my family, and my health. And then I do that tomorrow and the day after that. And it becomes stale very, very quickly. So in that case, what I say is you need to get quite specific with the things you are talking about. So if you're grateful, if you have been writing, say, I'm grateful for my family. Okay, well, who in your family? What about them? What experiences do you have with that person that you are grateful for? What have they done for you? What can you do for them? This sort of thing. It doesn't always have to be something that's happened as well. It could be hypothetical. And the same thing with any sort of relationships. So the people in your life, like, don't just say you're grateful for your friends. Like, which friends? Which ones specifically? What fond memories or experiences do you have with that person? And you know, you can cycle through a lot before you run out when looking at it that way. And you know, if you can build up some momentum with it and start to activate your reticular activation system, so where you naturally become more accustomed to seeing things that you're grateful for, the little things, then you'll be able to more easily pick up those little things on a day-to-day basis. So you can use that big stuff initially to gain some headway, and then you'll be more adapted to being grateful anyway. And then, you know, it is kind of like a case of momentum. Once the object is in motion, it's a lot harder to stop it. So opportunities, any experiences. So there's a lot of material to work with there. And then, you know, just, and then also to have the emphasis that like, it doesn't have to be big stuff either. You know, if someone comes into work and they brought a coffee in for you, like that's pretty sound. You know, that you can definitely use that as an option. Yeah. And then to get people going on it, I think a journal, like a pre-designed journal that is like a template, makes it a lot easier to get started.
Ask so the questions,
yeah, with the prompts. So like the 5-minute journal is the one that I started with and recommend the most. There's a few kind of knockoffs of that, so you just have to make sure it's the proper one. So
yeah,
the one that's made by Intelligent Change, and that lasts for 6 months. And then, you know, after that point, I feel like you can just either create your own sort of template or just write in a blank notebook, yeah, or a copy.
You get into that routine of it anyway.
Yeah.
That's savage. That's something I'll definitely apply. And to those who are watching and listening, like it's something well worth trying. It can be very uncomfortable initially, like writing down that you're grateful for whatever happened that day. And then it's one of those things, kind of like we mentioned earlier about perspective, like eventually you go, right, this bad thing has happened to me, but I'm glad it has because it set a chain of motion or chain of actions in motion. And now I am who I am and this opportunity came out of it. And it helps you flip that perspective by being grateful from the get-go as well, doesn't it?
Mm.
Lovely. Something I wrote down, and I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about this or whatever, but you worked with Jess, who works in Perpetua, Jess,
yeah,
Armstrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she raved about you, like kind of going back to that nutrition stuff again, is whenever it does come to things like disordered eating, is it typically women that you see or men, or do you see more women for this thing and more men for this thing, or what's your perspective on it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely more common in women that I'm seeing this, and I think the overall like research data supports that it is women are more consumed by, say, body image issues, and they're more susceptible to like the effects of diet culture and things like that. So I think it's more common certainly for a woman to be tied up, to have her self-worth tied up in her physical appearance, but
yeah,
like at the same time, men are not safe from it. It's probably getting worse you know, in a way for men, because there is more of a shift towards like an ideal male physique now, I think, than there has been in previous points in time. So it's like, you know, to be more muscled and to be leaner, that's more on men's minds now than I think it has been in the past. And yeah, and it's kind of a similar shift for women as well, where it's like, it's not just being skinny or thin anymore. It's like, you know, have massive glutes, but also have a tiny waist, and also big boobs as well. And then, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to achieve, really, which is going to put more people in the situation where they're feeling like they don't compare and they're inadequate because of that. Yeah. You know, so you know, I've definitely worked with men on these kind of issues, certainly around, especially around binge eating and stuff like that, but it is more so women, because I think they're more, yeah, I think they're just blasted with diet culture,
yeah,
and these body image ideals more than men are. But like it's both,
works both ways,
both sexes are in the mix. Yeah.
Yeah. So with you then personally, like how do you balance, because I follow you on Instagram, so I see everything. So how do you balance like training, your work, your enjoyment of fine foods and fine wine, and still maintaining a physique that you're comfortable with and putting out an impression that people are still going to buy in and trust into you without losing, like how do you balance it all?
I would balance everything. Yeah, I suppose like having like scheduling is incredibly important. So like,
yeah,
you know, every night generally I will do a daily plan of how I want it to run. And now it doesn't always go to plan, naturally. And then one major mistake that I'm sure a lot of kind of hyper-productive people will make here is that they try and schedule like every fucking 15 minutes in the day. Yeah. And then as soon as you miss one thing or one thing that you're doing takes like
thing goes, yeah.
5 minutes longer than you had planned for, then it all falls apart. So you need to give yourself leeway. So if I am going to dedicate theoretically half an hour to a task, I will give myself 45 minutes. And then, you know, it's relatively easy for me to keep training because I enjoy it. And it's important to me and it's part of my identity. But at the same time, like I don't get stressed out if I can't train or if I have to miss a session because I'm busy, because I think I'm doing it for long enough and I have that kind of broader perspective that, you know, missing a session here and there because I was maybe, you know, had a bunch of work to do and that took the priority, kind of accepting and having that knowledge of what your priorities are and how they may change. You know, day to day or year to year, you know, because I went through a period where I was working a couple of jobs and doing that precision nutrition level 2 course. So I had very little time to train. So I was doing like 2, maybe 20 minute sessions a week, which is like,
wow.
is pretty poor by my own standards. But I also didn't tell myself I'm a piece of shit because I don't train more often. I say, okay, look, you have these other priorities right now. Like this course is not going to last forever. So you will get that time back. And while things are unfolding, just do what you can. So, you know, if it's a 20 minute circuit a couple of times a week, which is what I was doing, or an interval session on the assault bike, that's infinitely better than doing nothing.
Yeah.
So I'm never like black or white or, you know, set unrealistic standards for myself, and in doing so I can get a lot more done. And that ties into the whole nutrition thing as well. Now that you remind me of it, it's having perfectionist tendencies and standards really sets people back when it comes to their food, because if you don't hit your targets perfectly and you set that bar too high, then you are essentially failing every single day by your own standards, not anyone else's standards. Or maybe you've inherited those standards from somewhere, from misinformation or whatever it is. But it doesn't feel good to fail constantly. And if that's going to be the case, you're probably going to give up, or you're going to say, well, fuck this. And then you're going to binge. And then you say, oh shit, I shouldn't have done that. And I now have to try harder. So then the bar is set even higher.
Yeah.
So it's very, very important to start where you're actually at without making any nutritional or lifestyle changes.
I love it. That's something I preach all the time, and it's, people tend to be all or nothing if they're like that in their work and in their personal life, then they also bring it into their training and into their nutrition. And if they're supposed to train on Monday and they don't do it, the chances of them training the rest of the week is slim to none. And it's like, yeah, but you've missed one day. Let's get back on track and go from there. So how then do you balance getting into like your nutrition, because I know you like wine and I love wine, even though I'm doing dry January now, I don't miss it that much, but I do love it. Like, how do you bring that in without letting it completely derail you?
It's having that understanding of, you know, what boxes do I actually need to tick day to day or week to week with my nutrition, and, you know, how much is good enough? Like, instead of trying to be perfect, what's actually good enough? So it's like, I'll have non-negotiables. So you'll rarely find a day where I'm not hitting my protein intake. And you'll rarely find a day where I don't eat at least a few servings of vegetables and fruit. And like, you know, my standard for that is very, very high. So, you know, 2 portions of veg in a day is kind of low level by my own standards where I'm at now. But I have to build up to that. And then, you know, when you can do that and you have that awareness of how your nutrition fits into a week or a month, instead of saying, I have to get it right today, because if not, then everything goes to shit.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm never doing anything excessively. So, you know, I was fortunate enough to go down to South Africa. I did not bring that strained back. I will just say that because I got tested, so I was clean, man. Just before people jumped down my throat.
Blame
about
you,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was there in November, and man, the quality of food there and the standard of wine is exceptional. and it's all very, very cheap relative to, you know, what we pay here. Like, obviously it's relative to income down there, but like, you can get really, really fine dining for, you know, half or a third of the price of what you might pay here, or what I wouldn't pay here actually for it. I wouldn't be bothered with it. And yeah, that was 5 weeks away, but like, at the same time, I hadn't been drinking a lot during the year before that. Like, I'm not a massive drinker. Like, yeah, I do like my wine like yourself. But under normal circumstances, let's say, where I'm not down in the wine country, and it's not Christmas time, like, I might only have, you know, one or two glasses a week, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. I suppose just the fact that I don't have like a huge emotional attachment to food or alcohol or anything. Yeah. It's like, I really, really enjoy it. But if you said to me, you can't do that today, it's like, all right, fine.
Okay.
I have other things I can do. That's cool.
Savage. You brought up a point there, and I had written in my notes prior to this that I wanted to ask you about it. And you mentioned non-negotiables. So you have your protein and your veggies and stuff like that. What do you have for yourself? So tell me about your veggie intake, because I'm huge on that as well. And my clients need to hear it from someone else apart from me, how important it is. And then for your clients and for the people you work with, what do you set them non-negotiables, or do you build into it, or what way do you work with that?
Yeah. So first of all, for your clients, it's very important that your non-negotiables are individualized, I suppose, because, you know, what's non-negotiable for me for vegetable intake is not going to be the same as what is for somebody who's coming off, you know, a typical Western diet that may be pretty much devoid of vegetables. So again, that comes back to starting with where you're at, because, you know, if I eat 10 servings of vegetables a day, I can't expect a new client to have that as their standard. And
even be able to stomach it.
Yeah. No, the digestive tract won't take that kind of a beating in the first week. But so it's going to be individualized and it's going to be personalized, and it depends really on, you know, what their goals are. So it's like, you know, you for someone who's maybe tracking their calorie intake, it's like, and they have a fat loss goal, it's like, okay, maybe the bare bones non-negotiable is to try and, you know, stay within your calorie targets. And if your macro split is all over the place, that's not too big a deal. Maybe for food selection isn't as high quality as you'd normally want it to be, maybe that's fine. But again, you're usually looking at this across like a week or more. Like, it's never like, it doesn't ever have to be day to day. So, you know, it's like for training, it's like maybe your ideal is train 5 times a week, but maybe your non-negotiable is like, no, I'm going to get 2 sessions, like, no matter what happens.
Yeah.
You know, unless heaven falls, like, I'm getting those 2 sessions in. And then for my own actual personal non-negotiables, then it's like, I'm going to be hitting, you know, 1.5 grams per kilo of protein per day. And I'm not tracking my food, and I haven't for a while. I've spent a long time tracking my food, so I've got that kind of understanding, got the benefit from it. I wouldn't do it necessarily unless maybe I had some specific fat loss targets, like with a short end date. But even then, I usually just take the lazy option and like intermittent fast, or like narrow my food selection down, so I'm just really full and I know what I'm eating. You know, sleep is going to be a big non-negotiable for me. Like, kind of, I want to say I learned the hard way, I'm not gonna be dramatic about it, but, you know, when I was in college, like, I went through a year, or, well, no, a college year is nowhere near a full year. So one college year, like, people, you know, people in college talk about that, but it's like, well, a college year is like 24 weeks or something like that, of when you're actually in there. But, you know, I was going on like 5 hours sleep a night, because I had quite a significant commute, and then there were long days, and I was like, and I also wanted to keep training, because I was like, no, I have to keep training. And, like, you know, my training didn't go anywhere. I was, you know, I wasn't as aware of calories back then. So I was eating too much as well. So I ended up in worse shape and not any, you know, stronger or physically fit, because I was going on, you know, way too little sleep basically. So since then I've been a massive, massive proponent of the importance of sleep. And, you know, I do think it's like the number one thing that people could look at to improve their health and well-being. So, you know, getting 7 hours of sleep at least is going to be a non-negotiable. And like, of course, like that doesn't mean that I never, ever in my life get less than 7 hours of sleep, but it's just like, that's kind of a standard that I've set for myself. And then for vegetable intake, you know, I'm not eating as much vegetables right now as I have in the past. Like when I peaked there probably a year or two ago, I was probably hitting on like 15 to 20 servings of plants per day. So
between fruit and veg.
Yeah, man, like I would roast up a few trays of veg, like a couple of times a week, and I'd put them into Tupperware, and each Tupperware was 5 servings, and I would have one with, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Savage.
Plus whatever fruit I was having. Yeah. And maybe if I was having a soup or something, that's usually a good one to help get it in. Now I don't think you need to have that many servings per day, but you know, people should push up to probably like, you know, 5 to 8 servings, and more, because it's a rare case where you can have too much, and like, you know, they contain a lot of nutrients, so vitamins and minerals and phytonutrients that are exclusive to the plants themselves, that aren't classed as vitamins or minerals. They're going to provide those. They're good for health. It's fairly, there's not a lot of things in nutrition that are conclusive, but it's pretty conclusive that the people who eat more fruit and veg tend to be healthier, have less risk of, you know, chronic disease and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, great source of fiber, which is, very, very useful for health purposes, eating enough fiber. And it tends to be something that, people don't eat enough of, generally speaking. So eating more fruits, vegetables is a great way to bump up your fiber intake. You know, fruit's really tasty as well. You know, it's sweet and helps satisfy a sweet tooth. I definitely argue for the fact vegetables are very tasty if you know what to do with them.
Yeah,
because like I don't fucking want overcooked, like limp broccoli there.
Steamed Brussels sprouts.
I don't want all that plain stuff. Like, so that's why, like I said, I roast so much of my vegetables, because you can season that nicely with like some chili flakes, garlic, balsamic vinegar. I did some Brussels sprouts last night. So parboiled them and then put them in a pan with cumin seeds with like a spray of oil. And, you know, that's much, much better. And it doesn't take any more effort.
Yeah.
Like, you know, enjoying your food is
so important.
Is huge. And then obviously vegetables are so filling that for anyone who has fat loss goals, you know, it's almost like a prerequisite, I would say, for having a successful time of fat loss, because one of the biggest limiting factors is going to be being hungry and then adherence slipping. Yeah. So, you know, I will say, you know, to most of my clients after a certain point, like, you know, it's pretty much a requirement that you're going to have to eat a certain amount of fruit and veg per day and eat enough protein, if you want to have an easy time with this, you know, if their adherence isn't good, for example. So yeah.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. What are your thoughts then? You kind of mentioned it a little bit, on fasting, like how often do you do that? How often do you prescribe it to people, or is it just something that you do occasionally?
Yeah, I can use it as like, it's another tool in the toolbox for working with clients. So I'm never going to be pegged as any kind of guy. You're never going to hear someone say, oh, Brian's the intermittent fasting guy, or Brian's the keto guy.
Brian's the vegetable guy.
Yeah, I'm the vegetable guy. The non-vegan vegetable guy. Yeah, that's true. Okay, you caught me out there. but no, it's a useful tool for a lot of people, for, and like, you know, this is why nutrition has to be personalized and individualized, because it may work very well for you and it may not work very well for me or somebody else. So it's about like saying like, look, okay, here are the options. this is what the intermittent fasting option might feel like and why it might be good and why it might not be so good for you as a person. And if you like the sound of that, we can give that a try. So you're always trying to give people options and say, look, okay, I've had people in your position in the past. They've tried intermittent fasting. It's helped them manage their daily calorie intake because, you know, if they fast until lunchtime, it means that those meals that they have between lunch and dinner are more satisfying. So they might, and it's, you know, it's relatively easy for a lot of people to, you know, skip breakfast, just stay hydrated, maybe have some coffee or whatever it is. But it's not the case for everybody. So not everybody's going to be suited to that. And, you know, I'll do different forms of intermittent fasting for people as well. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be a daily, you know, 16-hour fast, 8-hour eating window. It could be once a week, a 20-hour fast. So you can eat more normally for those 6 other days, because some people might prefer that than, say, like a consistent drop in calories across the whole week. So it's just another tool, and it's not something that I like love myself. It's just I kind of naturally end up doing it maybe. And, you know, if I have, like, the last time I was kind of trying to lose weight or fat under pressure was like for jiu-jitsu competitions. So, you know, I did like a 2-week pretty aggressive diet where, you know, I skipped breakfast. So I was having lunch and dinner and then like maybe a snack, and I was being very, very diligent about my food choices. So it was like loads of vegetables, actually being conscious of my vegetables because I eat so many of them that they do contribute a significant amount of calories. But you know, lean protein, a lot of potatoes, just because they're like the most filling of the starchy carbohydrates. And you know, and for the sake of that 2-week stretch, I was not by any means going to be like, oh, I'd love just some like chocolate or I'd love some sweets.
Yeah,
now.
You know, it's
like,
on either window.
Yeah, for the sake of 2 weeks, you know, I can stick with that. I was having chocolate protein milk, I think, so that's very enjoyable. Yeah. And then I do like, there's quite interesting research coming out, sort of in relation to time restricted feeding. So, it's not. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like all time restricted feeding is intermittent fasting, but not all intermittent fasting is time restricted feeding. Yeah. You might say. So time restricted feeding is eating in a window, but starting it earlier. So it aligns with your circadian rhythms. Right. So it's like, you know, if you have your breakfast at 8 o'clock, then you're in the morning, like your clock starts then. And the aim is usually to try and eat within at least a 12-hour window. And that's pretty manageable for most people. Like there's research done on 8-hour windows and 10-hour windows. They're not as practical, I don't think. You know, if you have your breakfast at 8, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to have your last meal at 4.
Yeah, especially if you just work a regular 9-to-5, like you're kind of...
Exactly, like you're likely going to come home and have dinner with your partner or your family or whoever else. So it's not that practical. And what's practical is much more important than what's optimal for
that.
People. Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes. You know, practical is greater than optimal, basically. But this research is particularly interesting in relation to, say, shift workers, because the idea is that it lines up with your circadian rhythm better. So, like in terms of, say, body composition, it's all kind of the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have 500 calories at 3 a.m., the kind of metabolic effect, it seems, is not the same as if you had it at 3 p.m. Okay, because your digestive processes are not supposed to, for the lack of a better term, be up and running in the middle of the night. So what you see is improvements in like blood sugar management, improvements in things like blood cholesterol. So none of that stuff is going to relate to, you know, how defined are your abs, but it's relevant to health. And as such, for people that I have working shift, where possible, we'll set things up so that they're not eating very much between about midnight and 5 a.m. To try and account for that. So,
savage.
Again, it's very individual and depends on the person. So,
but you know, we work with them.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you are going to have something in that in the middle of the night, it seems like high protein foods are best. So lower fat and lower carbohydrate, and high protein foods have the best overall effect. You know, you might have some high protein fat free yogurt, and you might have some berries or something with that. And that's cool.
Yeah. That's deadly. That's something I haven't really looked into, and it's, we have a few shift workers in here, so that's definitely worth looking into more for me anyway. To finish up then, a couple of things for you. You mentioned roasting, and you mentioned that you fry your Brussels sprouts after parboiling them. Would they be your, what are your go-to things to help people increase their vegetable intake?
Yeah, so absolutely. Like, the roasting is just, there's not anything special about roasting as such. It's just that it makes the veg taste a lot nicer. So,
yeah.
And it's quite conducive to meal prep as well, which is helpful. So,
yeah.
You know, if you can get a big tray of mixed vegetables, you know, so I'll do like carrots, parsnips, broccoli, maybe cauliflower, aubergines, courgettes, red peppers is very important actually for the flavor, because roast red peppers taste great. Yellow peppers, kale, mushrooms, like all that stuff, you can just get into a tray. Some of that stuff cooks faster than the others. So it can be like carrots and parsnips go in first, and then 15 minutes later, maybe the rest goes in.
Yeah.
And then like a total cook time of like half an hour. But, you know, putting some olive oil on that, either pouring it or a spray. And then you can season it, like I was saying. So one of my favored recipes is chili flakes and balsamic vinegar and plenty of garlic. And nice. I'm happy to just eat that for a lot of meals. So that comes under kind of like food preparation to make it easy to do. Because then once those trays are made, provided you have the space to store them, like it's the easy option to have that. And sometimes I'll blend up the Tupperware, like put it into a blender and just make soup out of it. If I want a bit of a change, or you can make soup yourself. Soup is very, very easy to do in a slow cooker. Like I use a slow cooker a lot, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And you know, if you have a big pot of soup there, and you can say, okay, I'm going to have a bowl of soup with like every meal, or two out of three meals, or whatever it is.
It's just easy veg.
Trying to sneak veg into like composite dishes, like, you know, bolognese or chilies, curries, stews. Because if you can do that, which you can, like it's very easy to cram a lot of veg in there. And then if you can also prepare some veg on the side, then you're getting a lot of veg by the time you're getting around to a meal. And then another key one would be making like smoothies. So if you make a smoothie with it, which is like half full of spinach leaves, and then some fruit and protein powder or whatever else you might have, those are some easy ways to get more veg in. And
I think
people, like, you know, you can essentially steam broccoli in less than 3 minutes in the microwave. Like if you put it in a bowl, obviously chopped, and then put it in a bowl with a little bit of water and cover it, like, and microwave for 2 to 3 minutes, it's basically ready to go. You can wilt spinach if you pour boiling water over it into like a colander, and that's that you've cooked vegetables in about 10 seconds in that case. And that's something I'll do a lot, because convenience is important as well. And having, say, frozen veg in the freezer to just throw in the microwave,
backup option as well.
If you haven't done the shop or something, or you're stuck, it's like, oh, okay, I can still do this because I'm prepared in that sense.
Love it. What about then philosophy? What would be your recommendations for your go-to if someone's interested in it but doesn't know where to start?
I think obviously there's more to philosophy than just Stoic philosophy and Stoicism. And I'm trying to read more broadly in philosophy now as well. But that's always going to be my baby, I think. You know, it's a great blueprint for living and helping you deal with life and having good perspectives and being a good person and all that important stuff. So I think the Daily Stoic, the book, like, it's, you know, the format is that you read one page a day, makes it very, very accessible to people. It's not expensive. It's usually around 10 euro or less.
It's about 10 euros,
And then I think Ryan Holiday's other books about Stoicism are quite accessible too. So The Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy. I suppose stillness is the key, counts in that as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think start with the Daily Stoic and, you know, let that, and then, you know, podcasts and things can be good, and let that foster kind of an interest in it. And, you know, you don't need to put yourself under pressure. You don't have to read the primary texts. Like, there's no bonus points really for it. Like, I know part of my ego is definitely like, yeah, you're going to sit down, you're going to read Nietzsche's entire works.
and then your head explodes.
But you don't have to do that. Like, it's whether the shit actually makes your life better or not. Like, it's no bonus points being like, oh yeah, I read all those works and that's it. I've read them.
Cares.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then last one, what would be your top wine recommendation?
Okay. So I will have to admit, right, James, that because I've been fortunate enough to go to South Africa a few times and I have family down there, which is why. So my wine palate is very narrow to South Africa. Okay.
Perfect.
But I am getting in, like, obviously I like other wines. I like Spanish and French wines and stuff, but I take the most interest in wines when I'm in South Africa. But I generally like a Cabernet Sauvignon.
Nice.
The best wine that I had when I was down there this time, that, and I brought a bottle back, was the Constancia Glen number 3. So that's a red blend. I definitely have a preference for red.
Yeah, me too.
So that's a very specific, you know, you want the vineyard and you want which bottle. That's what I'm going to say is my favorite wine right now.
I love it. That's a great answer, man. I love how excited you got about answering that question as well. That was perfect. Brian, that was
great for me.
Yeah, that was absolutely deadly. Where can people find you on the socials, on the interwebs? What's your tags?
Yeah, so I'm fairly active on Instagram, as you know. So that's at Brian O'Hangusa. I'm sure you check the show notes for the spelling, but it's BrianOhangusa. You can find out about the services that I offer in terms of nutrition coaching at triagemethod.com. And there's a tab for nutrition coaching where you can just do /nutrition coaching. That's linked on my Instagram page as well. And then, you know, the Triage Method Instagram page is a good resource too. So yeah, those are the main places to find out more. And
superb.
Yeah, feel free to reach out, anybody who is watching or listening to this.
Definitely highly recommended. Brian, thanks a million, man. Great having you on.
Thank you for having me, James. I will chat to you soon then.
Yeah, chat to you soon, my man.